again, so Parshas Vayetze, we have the beginning of the parasha discusses a little bit of Yaakov's journey from his parents' home to the house of Lavan. And Perek Chavtes begins with the actual traveling. Yaakov starts walking towards the east. And he sees a well. And there are three flocks of sheep beside it. This was the be'er. This was the well that everybody came to feed their animals from, to drink from. And there was this large rock on top of the be'er, on top of the well. And everybody would gather there, all the shepherds, the galu, and they would together roll off this very heavy stone, and that way they would be able to give their sheep to drink. Come on, when they were done, together they would return the stone. And Yaakov asks them, where are you from? We come from Haran. He asked him, "Hayidatem es Lavan ben Nachor? Do you know Lavan, the son of Nachor, who he was looking for?" Vayomru yadano, we do know him. Vayomru lohem hashalom lo, is everything okay with him? Vayomru shalom, yes. And look, v'nei Rachel bito ba'a imatzon, Rachel, his daughter, is coming with his sheep. Vayomru hein odayom gadol, away se yosef ha'meknah, shkua son l'churu. There's still a lot of daytime left. Why are you all standing around here? Give the sheep something to drink and go about shepherding. We have to wait for everybody to come in order to remove this large rock of air. And then, and after we remove it from the top of the well, then we can give the sheep to drink. And as they're speaking, and Rachel comes with her father's sheep, because she was a shepherd or shepherdess. She took care of her father's sheep. When he sees his mother's brother's daughter Rachel, and the sheep of Lavan, Yaakov goes by Yogel, so Evan, he somehow garners together this superhuman strength, and he himself pushes the stone off of the bear. When he gives the sheep to drink, and Yaakov kisses Rachel, and he begins to cry. Then he tells Rachel who he is, and that he's the son of Rivka. And she goes and she tells her father. Okay, and then the story continues. Maybe we won't pass it. By he gishmo Lavan Hashem Yaakov ben Achoso. When he hears that Yaakov, his sister's son, is there, Vayaris the Kraso, he goes up to him, he runs him, Vayichabeklo, and he hugs him, Vayinashiklo, and he kisses him, Vayivieu al Beiso, and he brings him back to his house, Vayisaperlo Lavan, it's called Adavorim Oila, and he tells him everything that's going on, and then the rest of the story unfolds, and he marries Rachel and Leah. So the question that every high school kid asks, and everybody else thinks while they read the pasuk, is how could Yaakov kiss Rachel?
I will just answer the question.
There we go. So that's what we're going to talk about today. How could Yaakov kiss Rachel? The story just sounds very, very strange. He goes up, finds out who she is, and goes over and kisses her, and they cry, and then afterwards he decides to introduce himself. Right? The next pasuk is... What?
Rashi doesn't even talk.
Many other questions.
Ignore it.
But it's a taboo.
That should be a question.
We'll see.
I'm going to try to
give a little bit of an introduction before we get to what the different mepharshim have to say about this.
Yeah, how many times I've read this? And it's the first time.
Really? I think everybody in high school asked this. Well, what do you mean? Yaakov kissed Rachel. Really? Okay, maybe not. So if anybody, the children come home and ask this, right. Suddenly they all wake up. Okay, so that's the question. So again, just before we look at the Midrashim and at the Mepharshim, let's try to put everything in a little bit of context. Start with one story. A friend of mine teaches Navi in a modern Orthodox yeshiva. And he as he was trying to figure out how he was going to teach certain stories, he was at a wedding and he met Rabbi Reisman at this wedding. So he decided Rabbi Reisman would be a perfect person to ask. So he walks up to Rabbi Reisman, he never met him before, introduces himself, and he says, "My name is so-and-so, and I teach Navi at a Mar Zak school." And he says, Rabbi Reisman says to him, "I hope you don't have to teach the story of David and Bathsheba." And he goes, "Well, that's exactly what I was coming to ask you about." So one thing that I think Rabbi Reisman suggested in terms of putting it into context, which I'll mention here as well, is he said, imagine that you open up the newspaper in the morning, and in the newspaper it says the most heinous, terrible thing you could possibly imagine about the person that you admire, that you respect the most. Yeah, not just like a random person, whoever that person is, whether it's a Rebbe, whether it's a parent, whoever that person might be, and you open up this... So what's your reaction? Can't be. It must be the person was framed. It must be something was misconstrued. That's the immediate reaction to try and put it into context. So he said, certainly in terms of at least how you're approaching any time where there's a story where it's not 100% clear what happened, when you're dealing with David, you know, Melech Yisrael, the Melech, the one who, from whom Mashiach is going to come, when you're dealing with the Avos, who, again, beyond our comprehension, how amazing and what a high level these people were on, the initial reaction needs to be, it's not that we're looking for an excuse, but it's just, it can't be. How can it be? So again, it's a little bit of a context. In terms of the alternative explanations, it's not that, you know, we're trying to justify it. We're trying to re-explain the truth. This couldn't be what happened. Just put yourself in a similar situation, and obviously that's what you do. And it certainly shouldn't be any less when you're dealing with the Avos. The truth is, you see that approach in Chazal as well, from a comment that Rashi makes on the last pasuk that we read in Pasuk Yud Gimel. It says that Lavan heard that it was Yaakov, Vayaratzik, Rasson, he runs to him, Vayachadek, Lo, Vayanashik, Lo, and he hugs him and he kisses him. Sounds fairly innocent. This is Yaakov's uncle. He hasn't seen him. So his uncle goes and he gives him a hug and a kiss. What does Rashi say? It says, Vayachadek, Lo, Rashi says, Kishalo Ra, Imokum, when he saw he wasn't coming with anything, with any wealth, Amr Shema Zehuvim, Hevi Vihino Mecheko. Maybe if I hug him and I feel around, maybe he has some gold hidden away somewhere on his person, and he has some sort of riches. Vainashik Lo, Amr Shema Margolios, Hevi Vihim Mepit. He kisses him on the mouth to try and figure out if he hid diamonds inside his mouth. So, it is crazy. We'll try to put all that into a little bit of context also. But how did Chazal know that was true? Rashi was quoting from Chazal.
Yes.
But why did they think to assign this? Lavan, why couldn't it be that Lavan simply hadn't seen his nephew in a long time? What is it about the pasuk that makes it so clear that Lavan was doing these things with these ulterior motives? So Revolvi mentions, and this is a theme in his Sefer on Chumash, which had a large impact on me. Revolvi, he was a Mashkiach in Eretz Yisrael for a long time, passed away a few years ago, but a tremendous impact, a very profound thinker. And he says this in many contexts, but he says it here as well, that in Chazal it's clear that when the Torah talks about characters, again, it generally isn't just telling us stories. There's much more that we're supposed to take away from the stories than simply the simple understanding of the story. And the characters that are mentioned and the people that are mentioned are you know, sophisticated and are also supposed to be teaching us these lessons as well. And as a general rule, Chazal understood that when the Torah speaks about a Rasha, then the assumption is that whatever he's doing is Rishas. We're not Dan the Kazakos, we don't give him the benefit of the doubt, because once the Torah portrays this person as this wicked person, then it's supposed to be that we interpret events in that light. And says, therefore, it was automatic to Chazal to understand that once there was Vayechadik Lo Vayinashik Lo and comes to Lavan, so seemingly there must have been something else. You can't assume that he has any pure motives. So Lahavdil, the opposite is obviously true. When it comes to the Avos or the Imos trying to figure out the stories, and it comes up a lot in this expression with Leah and with Rachel, the episode with Leah withholding the Dudaim, whatever these flowers were from Rachel. You have to delve deeply and try to understand exactly what's happening in these events and interpret them appropriately. So again, the same way Chazal assign guilt to a person who's known to be guilty, the opposite is true also. And generally they'll find the cops of us, they'll find the positive and the way of explaining in a favorable way when it comes to the avos. Okay. A few more words of introduction. First of all, we're going to assume, like Chazal generally assume, that the Avos kept the entire Torah, and that the Avos somehow were able to intuit what the will of God was, and somehow, even without having been commanded in the formal mitzvot, both the biblical commandments and also the rabbinic ones, somehow they were sensitive to it, and that's why the Mefarshim spends a long time on such episodes as Yaakov marrying two sisters, well, Hakanah beads against the Torah. Okay, and the Ramban explains that was a unique situation, but as the general rule, we assume that they did follow the mitzvot of the Torah. So what iser, what prohibition are we talking about? Just to put things in context, Yaakov is kissing Rachel, so what prohibition are we dealing with? So she's not married, as far as we know, she's not married to anybody else. He's going to marry her shortly.
And you end up in the Gita.
Well, let's figure out what prohibition that is. Okay. So she's not an erva, but she's not somebody who is forbidden to him. She's not necessarily permitted yet, but not somebody who's forbidden to him. It's not his sister. It's not somebody that he can't marry, and it's not somebody who's married to somebody else. So the other prohibition, which potentially exists, is that she was a nida, and there's no reason to assume that. Again, first of all, in terms of her age, which we'll talk about soon also, but even if she was of age, the same way that the avos were sensitive when it came to the mitzvot, presumably the imahos also were, and I don't think tumah and tahara would be any different. And tumah and tahara was something, and becoming pure from nida is something which exists outside, again, in an ideal world, that when you have the Beis HaMikdash and you have tumah and tahara, is something which is not necessarily between husband and wife. It has to do with just the general status of being pure. So there's no reason to assume that she was a nida. So what prohibition is it? So it's probably just something which is inappropriate. You know, it's not something for a good Jewish boy to be doing. Again, in terms of our context, most situations are going to be dealing with either it's somebody who's married or somebody who is forbidden to us, or
say a high school student.
You can figure out what you want to say. You can figure
out.
Well, we're getting there. I'm not giving it to high school students. That's why I'm giving it to you.
And this is a part that our teacher, our Rebbe, used to say, it's not important, let's skip.
Right, so that was one reason that I want to talk about it, because that bothers me. And I think the Torah does have an approach to everything, and it's a matter of drawing it out. So would I say everything the same way with a different audience? Probably not. But we're all friends. So we're going to learn it together. So again, she's not married. So again, it's something which just seems to be that it's more inappropriate, something which would probably be forbidden because of some sort of extension of being careful what you're doing in the day in terms of your hurei aveira, in terms of thinking improper things about somebody who's not permitted, in terms of the potential for omissions and things like that. But not, again, in terms of the technical prohibition, we're not dealing with what we would, you know, at first glance think we're dealing with, which is some sort of the Harig Vayavor, this is Giloy Arayos, he should have allowed himself to die before doing this. That's not what we're dealing with. So now let's try to begin looking at the Mefarshim and try and see their different understandings. And again, having that context in mind, and we'll see, even the Mefarshim, just from the flow of the Psukim, try and figure out exactly what's going on here. Let's start with what we'll call the most extreme formulations. We'll start with the Ksav HaKabbalah. The Ksav HaKabbalah says that the kiss never took place. Okay. No more problems now, right?
Okay.
So what does the pasuk mean? So he quotes a pasuk. He quotes a pasuk in. Where's the pasuk? Sorry, give me a second. He quotes a pasuk in Tehillim of Tzedek v'Shalom Nashku, that Tzedek and Shalom merged together. And he says, near the Faresh in Arakandas, Nishika Dikan, this kiss, his Chabrus Machshavi, a coming together, a meeting of the minds, his Dabgus Ritzoni, and a coming together of a person's wants or needs. Kinyan, the same as Tzedek Vishom Nashka. Shetayim Vishad Tzedek, Yumadubak Yamashalom Vlo Yifridu. The Pasuk is talking about Tzedek, that justice and peace need to be joined together. And it's the same word, Nashka, again. So, obviously, by Tzedek and Shalom, there's no real other way to interpret it. In Tzedek and Shalom are.
Cases, Tzedek and Shalom are.
Are concepts. Right, so, exactly. So, there there's no alternative way. So, he's suggesting is that the Torah. Again, so it's the most extreme formulation. He was suggesting is that, so nothing took place here. What happened? The time by Yishak Yaakov the Rachel, Shechi Berimo B'machshaveh V'ratzona, they had this certain bonding experience together, which brought them together. Kedamrin, like the Gemara Megillah says, Amarlo Yaakov min Savasli, will you marry Amarlo? And, yeah. And that's really what it means, is that it was a joining together perhaps of the mind and the spirit.
I like
which,
the interpretation better.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're going to see. That's what he suggests. The other extreme says that they were he certainly did kiss her, but suggests that they were already married. How were they already married? So this is the in the Sefer Vayidaber Moshe from Moshe Chaim Palach. He suggests like this: Yaakov, Rachel comes and she needs to feed her, needs to have her sheep drink, and everybody's waiting around because they can't give the animals to drink yet because they have to remove this big rock that's on top of the bear. Yaakov comes and by himself removes the stone, and then not only removes the stone, but it says that he gives all of Rachel's sheep something to drink. So he says that we know that in order to be Mekadesh a woman, in order to marry a woman, you need to give her something. So he says, Yaakov, through providing and taking care of the sheep, actually did what could be halakhically considered to be a marriage. Again, assuming that she was on the same page, but can halakhically be considered to be a marriage. And through that, Yaakov married Rachel. Again, because you don't need to actually give money, you can give something which has value. And again, as long as it has value, that is good enough. What?
It wasn't his to give.
Wasn't his to give?
The water?
Well, he didn't steal it. So obviously it was available for anybody who wanted to feed the sheep.
I know, but when we get married, there's such a big inyan about it. You have to take ownership of the ring, and it's not like anybody could just give.
Right, because we're machmir on a lot of these things. The Gemara does talk about cases. It says, what if a woman says, dance in front of me, and with the enjoyment that I have from you dancing in front of me, we'll become married. Or he says to her, dance in front. I'll dance in front of you, and with that which you're getting, the enjoyment of seeing me dance, we'll be married. So the Gemara assumes that it's kedushin. Because you're giving her something of value. So again, we try, again, especially when it comes to the area of marriage, we want everything to be 100%, 100% glad, 100% clear, no question. That's why we only use a ring. We don't use anything else. We don't even allow a stone to be on the ring, because we're afraid that maybe she'll think the stone has a certain amount of value, and he's being Mekadesh with his $10,000 diamond, and really it's a fake, or it's only worth $1,000. And then maybe she wouldn't have had, she didn't have that in mind, then she wouldn't have gotten herself involved with such a guy. Whatever there is, again, so we try to make things as simple as possible when it comes. So the fact that we don't do it is more because we're hypersensitive to making sure that everything is as clear as possible. We're not dealing with any of the quote-unquote funnier cases, any of the different cases. That's what he said. So didn't they get married afterwards? And he switches, Leah and switches Rachel. Because yeah, that was part of, they were playing along in terms of what Lavan wanted to do. But in terms of technically being married, he was already married to Rachel. Okay, so nobody likes that one either. So now let's get to the mainstream ones.
The Lashon is also the same, right?
I'm sorry.
The Lashon is also the same. Vayash, are you shocked?
So some people do point that out. Somebody wanted to say, I think in some of the, you mean between giving them to drink and the kiss, right? So some want to suggest that here means pouring also. I think in the Chassidus Sfarim, meaning he somehow poured some sort of spirituality into her, meaning Mayim, Ein Mayim Ela Torah. So in the first one,
okay.
You raised the point. I'm trying to be honest here. So, okay, so those are, what we would call the extreme formulations. Now we'll try to deal with more of what the mainstream of Farshim say. And I think what we more intuitively understand is that he kissed her, they weren't married, and those two facts will be our givens. Okay. So, most of the Mefarshim do take that simple understanding, again, that he certainly did kiss her and they were not married, and then now how do we address that? So, there are several approaches. Rabbeinu Bache and the Ramban both suggest that she was a ktana. She was a young girl. And this was his cousin. Never seen his cousin before. Again, there was nothing particularly affectionate going on. It's the same thing as when you see your niece, you see your cousin, who's, again, they try to figure out, the age of Rivka is very complex. The Torah doesn't give us much to work with in terms of figuring out exactly how old she is. They suggest, perhaps, that she was even as young as 5 years old.
Wait, Rivka or
Rivka? Rivka.
You said
Rivka. Oh, I'm sorry, Rivka. Rivka, sorry. Rivka. Yeah, Rivka was three. No, this is, I'm sorry. In figuring out Rivka's age is complicated. We don't have much to work with. So they suggest perhaps that she was even as young as 5 years old. And that's why with the extra 7 years, she became 12 years old, which was a more normal age to begin. Okay, Rivka got married younger, but a more normal age to get married. So that's what Rabbeinu Bache and the Ramban both says, and they try to find some support for it in the Psukim. So the Rabbeinu Bache points to two points in the Psukim that he thinks support the idea that she was younger. The first is, he says, why was Rachel the one who was out with the sheep and not Leah?
Mm-hmm.
Leah was older. Why Leah should have been the one out with the sheep, or maybe Leah should have joined together with Rachel taking on the sheep.
She had a problem with her eyes, Leah.
It says because she was crying a lot, so I don't know if they were red. They were, okay, maybe that's one possibility. But we never see that hampering anything else that she's doing later on in any of the later on any of the parshios. So he says, why was Rachel out and not Leah? So he says, just because Rachel was much younger and Laban knew the types of men that were going to be out there with their flock of sheep. So he said he'd much rather, instead of having his grown daughter be out there. So he took this little girl and didn't think she would be as susceptible to the men who were going to be out there. And he says that's why
he
was...
He didn't have his daughters at all. Why not hire a shepherd?
He's cheap. I don't know.
It sounds like the worst of two evils. He doesn't want to send out his older daughter to be with the men, so he sends out his younger daughter instead. Yeah.
Okay, I don't know. That's one suggestion. That's one suggestion that he makes. The other one is, he points to the fact in the Psukim is that he says that Yaakov keeps mentioning that it's Lavan Achi Imo. He puts everything in the context of being his mother's brother. And he says, and that's why he says, let me see if I can, there's everything that was happening and everything that he was feeding to her, it wasn't to show any honor to Lavan, but only to show respect for his mother. And he says, that's where the energy, some interpret that the energy, you know, it sounds like he sees Rachel, and suddenly he gets all this energy, and he can take off the even from this rock from the top of the bear. So some say, you know, he was so, you know, thrown head over heels for Rachel, that he had this superhuman strength. He says, no! He says it was really because he saw that he was going to be able to do what his mother wanted. It was out of his excitement to be able to do what his mother had sent him to. His mother sent him to find somebody appropriate, find somebody from the house of Lavan. And now that he's able to do what his mother was doing, that's what gave him the strength. That's why he keeps introducing in the Psukim as this Tzon Lavan, Achi Imo, Fayagid Yaakov, the Rachel, Ki Achi Avihu,
Why would Rivka send Yaakov himself to go pick out his own wife?
As opposed to
Avram sent Eliezer.
No, well, it sounded like the simple understanding was that Avram would have sent Yitzchak and not Eliezer had Yitzchak been allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael. I guess we do trust the men to make decisions on their own. I don't know. I guess it happened to be that Yaakov was a little bit running for his life as well. He needed to escape from Esav. And he says, and so he the Ravina Bachi House of Akhnei Shayadam Choshe Kitiba Shiaka Baroso Asrachel Nimshach Akar Tava Gufane. So wasn't it some sort of a physical attraction that suddenly gave him the strength? The host of Bokoach, the Gulat 7, that gave him the strength to take off this rock. Marshal Yahusim Echila, because he didn't do it initially when he came, so what gave him the strength? No, it wasn't that. The Kachlut Rachlama Kamapan Machimo. The Horos Kiloni Tosef Koach Vitibo Lavas Rachel. It wasn't because out of love of Rachel that he suddenly had all this extra strength. For the Hayalo Bari Asa Shimasorus, he wasn't suddenly, aroused in some way because he saw Kitibe Sharbani Adam, like regular people that might happen to him. Aval Kola Havas Imo, but everything was out of love for his mother. Some of the other Mefarshim point out one other, I don't know if you could say it's a proof, but at least a hint to the fact that she was much younger and that she wasn't the Gedola, is that it says that after he speaks with Rachel, Vayegid Yaakov Rachel ki achi aviyahu, he tells Rachel who he is, v'chi ven Rivkahu, and that he's the son of Rivka, v'ataris v'tagid le'aviyah. She goes back to talk to her father. Why not her mother? Rashi told us in last week's parasha, or 2 weeks ago, that when Rivka, it says that Rivka went back to talk to her mother after Eliezer came, and Rashi explains, because that was the normal thing to do. A grown girl goes to speak to her mother, doesn't go to speak to her father. She says, how come here Rachel went to her father and not to her mother? So he suggests, perhaps when it's still a young girl, so, father, mother, doesn't matter as much. When a girl gets older, so then that's what Chazal were highlighting, that she specifically has a special relationship and she would definitely go to her mother first and not go to her father.
It could also be that she went to her father to mention to him that her father's...
Because that was where the relationship, the blood relationship was there. Okay, yeah. That's why I wouldn't call it an ironclad proof, but again, in terms of trying to find hints in the text that can give us a glimpse of which way, so we suggest, some suggest that perhaps that's also a additional reason to believe that in fact she was younger. Ibn Ezra suggests something else. Ibn Ezra suggests, well, he says two things. First of all, he says that the pasuk of Vayaged Yaakov Zarachel Ki Achi Av Yehu, the pasuk in which Yaakov says that Yaakov is introducing himself to Rachel and explaining who he is, he says even though that's written after the pasuk of Vayishak Yaakov Zarachel, after he has already kissed her, he says it really happened first, and the Torah sometimes does not write things in the chronological order in which they took place, which again, no matter what understanding you say, makes it a little bit better, because it's a little strange that he just suddenly comes out of nowhere and gives this girl a kiss and then tries to explain who he is. If he introduces himself, so then at least there's a little bit of a context to it. And based on that, he suggests what seems to be a grammatical rule. Others suggest that it's not necessarily grammatical, but maybe he had some sort of kabbal that it was true. But he says there's a difference I think he's saying this in Tanakh, not just in the Torah. He says, Nishika im lamed biyad o bekasef o betzavar u beli lamed bepeh. He says that whether the Torah says, if the Torah just says Vayishak, or that somebody kissed somebody without saying to the person, here it says Vayishak Yaakov l'Rachel, it would have said Vayishak Yaakov Rachel, then that would have implied that he kissed her on the mouth, which again is some sort of more romantic type of kiss, as opposed to what's taking place here. It says Nishik l'imamed Vayishak Yaakov l'Rachel to her. It says that means on her hand, on her shoulder, on her neck, whatever. Again, the point being that it was something which is completely different. And he says that's really what was taking place here. And the Rabban says similarly that he kissed her on her clothing, meaning that it was some sort of greeting as opposed to being some sort of
romantic.
Of romantic act on his part. And again, in context of the next pasuk, it makes a lot of sense because Lavan comes right afterwards. He's kissing Lavan also. Nobody's making a big deal out of again. For now, just even assume the simplest fact. You assume the fancier shot of Rashi, so then you don't even have to say what the Ibn Ezra is saying. So you can suggest then, again, assuming that the assumption is that Lavan was trying to make it as not obvious as possible that when he was greeting his nephew, that he was trying to search out and see if he had hidden any gold, diamonds, etc. So when he kissed him, Rashi says that he kissed him on his mouth, it must have been that somehow that wasn't completely crazy, otherwise Yaakov would just, you know, like, what's wrong with you? And you don't seem to have that context. So again, then even without the Ibn Ezra, even if the derech was that they would kiss b'peh, then also that could still be that it was some sort of greeting. But again, that's what the Ibn Ezra and the Rabban suggests, that it was more of a greeting. Meaning again, and then the Rav Gerelich and other poskim have used this in terms of the question of handshaking of men shaking women's hands. They said that if you're shelo b'derechiba, if it's not something which has any you know intimate context to it, so then it's not technically prohibited. So to be able to extend that to a kiss as well obviously requires a different type of society. Again, here it was. Men to men. Also, it wasn't just men. It wasn't just men to women. Maybe that's a good litmus test in terms of understanding if it's just a greeting, or if it's something more than a greeting.
Because if you see, you know, on television, the Middle Eastern, you know, those Arab people when they greet each other, it's
right.
You know.
Right.
Fear of that care, you know, and then they want to stab each other and kill each other, but
it says he cried after.
Oh, I guess the crying also. The crying also is a...
I'm not sure that it's more of an emotional...
Right, the question is what emotion?
Right.
Right. Yeah, that's so Rashi says that he cried because he saw Piruach HaKodesh, that they weren't going to be buried together, right? Right.
Yeah.
We should suffer Piruach HaKodesh and Echnatasim HaLekura. So certainly it seems to be, again, in the context of the whole thing, that there was some sort of, I don't know if existential is the right word, but some sort of major event taking place when Yaakov and Rachel are meeting for the first time. And on a spiritual level, the fact that he's anticipating already and he's crying out the fact that not only does he know this is the woman he's going to marry, but he understands Baruch HaKodesh that it's supposed to be that he marries her and that they're not even going to be buried next to each other. So again, in terms of just trying to put in some context for us, we can't really relate, you know, on a practical level to such a thing, but we'll hopefully get there shortly. And the truth is the Medrash seems to say also that it was more of a greeting, and maybe it was just a greeting specifically between relatives, which would make a lot of sense if he introduced himself first and explained that he was a relative. And Rabbi Tanchuma says, Paisa Kravaso, and then you have this concept, he says it's a new category that you learn from this, of Neshika Shel Kravos, of a kiss that takes place between relatives, and that's what took place here.
But after he kissed, after
the Pasuk Yedbeis,
that's when he tells her that
Right, correct. So the Ibn Ezra suggests that the Pesukim are out of order, and that really he must have introduced himself more, because what kind of person would just run up to this girl, kiss her, and then try to explain who he is?
Okay,
so what am I hiding? So people quote two sources to try and claim that there was some sort of more romantic quality to this event that took place between Yaakov and Rachel. So we'll try to look at those sources and see what they really have to say. The first one is the Medrash that I just quoted before, this Medrash which I quoted from Rabbi Tanchuma, that Rabbi Tanchuma said that the kiss was this kiss between relatives. So Rabbi Tanchuma is the end of the Medrash. What does the Medrash say at the beginning? Medrash is going on this pasuk and it's expansive. Vayishak Yaakov to Rachel. Yaakov kissed Rachel. Kol neshika latiflos. Every kiss is latiflos. Not the best word to describe it. Meaning for more of a physical reason. Doesn't necessarily connotes something intimate, but again, something which doesn't have any spiritual quality to it. We'll leave it at that, maybe. Bar mitzvah, except for three. Neshika shel gedula, a kiss that you give to somebody because of the person's greatness. Neshika shel prakim, a kiss because you haven't seen somebody for a perek, for a large, long period of time. And neshika shel prishus, a kiss that takes place before two people separate. What are the examples? A neshika shel gedula is vayikach Shmuel aspach Hashem and vayitzok al rosho vayishakeyu. When Shmuel anoints Shaul to be the king, he gives him a kiss. What was that kiss about? This is the king. This is the Melech who Hashem quoted. So out of respect, out of kavod, out of the greatness of the king, he gave him a kiss. Neshika shel prakim, for not having seen each other in a long time. Vayelech vayef kishev v'har alokim v'yishaklo. Moshe and Aaron reuniting. Okay, so they hadn't seen each other. Brothers coming together. That's this the second category. And the last, Neshika Shel Prishus, separating, is Vatishak Orpa L'chamosa V'rus Dov Kaba, when Orpa is going to separate from Naomi, from her mother-in-law. It says that she gave her a kiss again. They're going to be separating for a long period of time. On that, after all this, Rabbi Tanchuma says, Af neshika shel krevus, you also have a category of a kiss between relatives. Shenemar v'yishak Yaakov l'Rachel, as the pasuk says, Yaakov kissed Rachel. So the simple, because the question is, what's the simplest reading of the measures? Again, you have Rabbi Tanchuma coming at the end, and you have what's called the Tanakama, the first author of the Mishnah, who's speaking at the beginning. So that author starts off by saying, any kiss is lotiflos, has no special quality to it, except for three, and then quotes these three categories, and doesn't seem to relate to what he opened with of the Vayishak Yaakov the Rachel, and then Rabbi Tanchuma fills in the blank.
Is that to say that it's okay then between relatives?
What word?
Yeah, sort of. We'll see. We'll see. On some level, yes. Well. We're not going to try to discuss too much practical halacha, but we'll see soon. We'll see soon. So the question is, what are the opening Tana, the opening author in the Medrash, what was he assuming? So there are those who write that obviously Rabbi Tanchuma at the end is coming to disagree, and since the opening author said that there are only three exceptions, and he doesn't mention Vayishak Yaakov l'Rachel, obviously what Yaakov did was Neshika Shel Tiflus, and it was inappropriate, and Rabbi Tanchuma is coming to disagree and to defend Yaakov. And on several accounts, I think that reading of the Medrash is completely wrong.
How can the Medrash leave it that Yaakov is wrong?
That's basically one problem. I mean, what's the purpose of the Medrash coming and saying that? Let's imagine for a second that he did something, that he, what he did was wrong. So what's the Medrash? I mean, the Medrash is coming to teach us something. That's generally what Chazal are teaching us, a deeper understanding. They're trying to teach us something. So if the point was, and the question would be, why would it be? Why is the Medrash generally does not come along just to tell us again, if the Psukim tells us that somebody did something wrong, so the Medrash might elaborate on what that person did wrong, or have their opinions exactly what that person did wrong, but the Psukim have something power of the event that took place here. It just seems to be part of the story. The Psukim don't imply that Yaakov did anything wrong. And then to open up with this pasuk, and then from that define all these other categories, and then if you're really, so what's the point in coming just to be critical of Yaakov? And if you are coming to be critical of Yaakov, so say it. If the point is to say that Yaakov did something wrong, and the Midrash wants to hide that Yaakov did something wrong, so tell me outright. And that would be the biggest message possible of the Midrash, is to say, and Yaakov did this, and Yaakov did this wrong. Midrash doesn't say that. So there are a few possibilities. So one is that Rabbi Tanchuma is filling in what the Medrash left, what the beginning left out. It's a little difficult to say that because he does say three categories, and Rabbi Tanchuma is adding a fourth. So it's a little difficult to say that. The alternative is to say that it's Neshika Shel Prakim. It's the same way that the Tanakhama has a category of a kiss where you haven't seen people in a long time. So here he had never seen this relative before. So again, so the discussion between Rabbi Tanchuma and between the Tanakhama is this a new category telling us something about unique between relatives? Or is it that when people are separated for a long time, again, here I guess the additional chiddush would be that they've never met each other, so it's not, but it's still a relative. I mean, there's still the time still is a factor, and that's what the Medrash is saying. The alternative is to say that the Medrash is highlighting that there are three categories that we can learn from, and the implication is that Yaakov is a completely different category that we can't learn anything from, because again, certainly if you take the context of that Rashi, that what's taking place here was some sort of spiritual event, that there was the coming together of Yaakov and Rachel, which then he realized on the spot they're not going to be buried together. Whatever this event was to take place obviously isn't Tiflus. It breaks the mold, but if I'm coming to tell you other categories, I can't learn anything out from that. I can't define a new category as being, you know, the kiss of Yaakov and Rachel, because there's nothing that we can ever imagine can compare. So I'll give you the three cases where we can learn something from. And Rabbi Tanchuma thinks, no, it was a special event that took place between Yaakov and Rachel, but I can still extend it to somehow between relatives as well. And the final reason that I think that the Medrash must be saying, like what I'm suggesting, that there's not, that it's not considered to be the Shikas or Tiflus, nothing inappropriate, is from the continuation to what Dina asked about before. Why did he cry? So the same Medrash continues to ask, why did he cry? And the Medrash offers three possibilities. I'm just going to read the last one. Loma Bacha, why did he cry? He saw people standing around whispering about the fact that he kissed Rachel. What were they saying? This stranger comes and he's starting to teach us all about this, inappropriate behavior. Since the world was destroyed with Doramabel, the nations of the world got together. They got Yoatzam and Erva, trying to be more careful about issues that pertain to the relationship between men and women. And he's coming along and he's doing this. And Yaakov realized that they were suspecting him. So again, the simple understanding is that this is true according to the entire Medrash, not specifically within Rabbi Tanchuma. So what the Medrash is saying is he was crying because his mistake was in a v'yisem nikiyim, in not doing things that people should suspect you, in terms of a maris ayin type of thing, that maybe other people didn't realize what was taking place here. If the first understanding of the Medrash was that he really did make a mistake and this was inappropriate, so that's why he should be crying. He shouldn't be crying because people suspect him. He should be crying because he needs to do tshuva because he did something inappropriate. So clearly, from the end of the Medrash, what you see is the other person who suggests that it was inappropriate brings this as a proof. Oh, you see, from the fact that he was suspecting him, that it must be that he acted inappropriately. I think the opposite is true. If he acted inappropriately, you should be crying about the fact that he acted inappropriately. Well, not what other people are thinking. Worry about yourself first. If all he had to worry about was that I knew that this was something which was correct, but I shouldn't have done it in this context because other people are going to get the wrong message, so then he has what to cry about. So that, I think, is the pshat in the Medrash. So there's one source left that we should look at. So the statement of Ibn Kasbi. Now, where exactly Ibn Kasbi? Ibn Kasbi was, I think, again, I tried to look into it a little bit, since he was a Talmud of the Rambam and the Ibn Ezra, around, again, in the period of the Rishonim. Now, not everything that's written from the period of the Rishonim automatically has the status as the everything else that the Rishonim write. There were a lot of people that lived at the time of the Rishonim, and it doesn't automatically make them into the Rambam or the Ramban or the Ibn Ezra or any of these other people. So generally speaking, we know from either the way they're treated by other Gedolim, meaning we know from other contexts, meaning most of them write in Halacha and Gemara also, and we know that it's been accepted, and then we know it's the same person, so if we learn the Ramban on every Masechta, so the Ramban on Chumash as well obviously has a tremendous amount of clout, and if the Ramban says something that seems difficult, it's our problem to try and figure out what the Ramban is talking about. The question is, when you have these, so you have the exceptions, Ibn Ezra doesn't write anything in Halacha, but we know that the Ramban treats the Ibn Ezra's opinion very, very seriously. So again, in the context of the way the other Rishonim treated him, you clearly understand what stature the Ibn Ezra had, and most Rishonim are like that. The question is, when you have these, like Ibn Kasbi, you really only have what he writes on Chumash, and doesn't seem to be quoted very much by the other Rishonim, so what status does it have? So again, in terms of being a parish, that's important to look at, I think, I don't see why it's not, and it's certainly no less important than anything from the last, 200 years, which is way after the Rishonim, in terms of being bothered by every detail of what he says. I'm not sure if we have to lose a night's sleep over something that he said that seems a little difficult. Okay, with that introduction, we'll read what he says. It says, Vayishak Yaakov l'racham, Ra'isi et ha'am kimisonen ema Yaakov she'osa ze'a pritzus. I've seen that people are can't believe and making fun of how could Yaakov have done such an inappropriate thing, kissing Rachel. Ubiprana chassidim eimanu vazikenim, the more pious, again, doesn't mean chassidim in our sense of chassidim, he's living in the year 1400 or so. But the more righteous people, the elders, they can't believe what's going on. He says, but for me, v'ani chai Hashem, by the word of God, eini mitzar al mikrazu, the pasuk doesn't bother me. Aval omer imzesh ein minagar tzlinshok bepeo belachi. It must be that the minag, the practice in the country at that time, was that they would kiss somebody, and there wouldn't be anything on the mouth, there wouldn't be anything that was inappropriate. The chalila lo velanu shayyo zebe perach manu l'slad, and chas v'shalom, that he kissed her on the mouth, there was nothing inappropriate. V'yem chas v'shalom master de Yaakov, and if chas v'shalom Yaakov did this, manu chalasos, what are we going to do?
Take it back.
V'yoter, but, so at that point it sounds like, okay, he entertains the possibility. Can I say that there's no possibility? I don't think there's no possibility. It's fine. I don't think I'd be bothered either, but what can we do? But again, I think we have a lot of alternative explanations. But I think the last line that he says right now, I think, is very telling into the manu chalasos isn't just, okay, so Yaakov Weiner is a sinner like me. Come on, it's Yaakov Avinu. So how does he finish off? He says, V'yoter chazuk mizeh asa Mashiach Elokei Yaakov v'harbei imo fedus. He says, more than this was done by the Mashiach, by David HaMelech, bringing us back to David and Bathsheba. So it's very interesting that he compares it to David and Bathsheba. Again, certainly not the time or the place to discuss at length the episode of David and Bathsheba. Again, it seems to be the simple reading of Psukim is that there was something inappropriate that happened between David and Bathsheba. And the Chazal say, Kol Omer David Chata, Einu Ola Toa. Anybody that says that David sinned is making a mistake. So the fact that he compares what Yaakov, on the side that, given the possibility that Yaakov did something wrong, what's the comparison? It's no worse than David. But even by David, the approach that Chazal take is one which almost frees him of anything. Exactly how you understand it. So again, just a little bit in terms of that most Nefarshim seem to agree that there was some sort of retroactive divorce that took place between Uriah, Bathsheba's husband, and Bathsheba. So again, in terms of there being a problem of Eshet Ish, of being a married woman, she's definitely not a married woman. Then it comes down to almost in a certain sense a similar question to Yaakov, meaning, well, what technical prohibition is there? Again, if she's not an Ida and she's not married. So again, it seems to be something which is more inappropriate, and obviously the extent to which David was involved with Bathsheba is much more than what took place with Yaakov and Rachel. So there are many explanations as to what took place there. Again, many suggest that there was some sort of idea of that, and I think this is certainly true in terms of trying to understand, especially in light of the Medrash of the crying that Yaakov, that Rashi brings, is that the same way that Yaakov and Rachel somehow, again, not in a physical love sense, but they realized that there was some sort of real bashert connection between them, that there was something real there, that in a certain sense maybe they jumped the gun a little bit in terms of what should have been for normal people, for them on their level, okay, maybe that was completely fine. And many explain that's what happened with David and Bathsheba also, that somehow they knew that they were meant to be together, again, not just on a physical level, that wasn't an infatuation, but on a spiritual level as well. And therefore, maybe they jumped the gun a little bit in terms of the process, and that is what the Navi is critical of him. But in terms of being a technical chait, we wouldn't go so far. So again, even the sources that are quoted as being the ones that Piryakov and not as positive a light, I think if you read them carefully, it doesn't seem to be what they're highlighting. To try and get the approach that I think is the easiest And suggested by some of the Mefarshim, which, again, which details you want to put in, you can kind of put in any of the Mefarshim, but in terms of the general approach, is that, again, the general prohibition or inappropriateness that we're dealing with, it's something which has to do with you know, a level of separating yourself, of creating this barrier between men and women to try and prevent anything inappropriate from happening. The Gemara in Ksubas says on Daf Yud Zayin, I don't think I have the exact quote here, but the Gemara in Ksubas relates the story of Rav Acha. And the Gemara in Ksubas says that Rav Acha, when he was at a, when he would go to a wedding, he would carry the kala on his shoulders. How could he carry the kala on his shoulders?
That's
a good question. Seems to be somewhat inappropriate. So the Talmidim asked him, "What are you doing?" I can't find it. No, sorry. But he basically explained to them that carrying her to me is no different than carrying a beam on my shoulders. Meaning, she's muteris. Again, we won't go through all the halachas in terms of the kala case, in terms of before marriage, what exactly constitutes the marriage. The point being that when it comes to these types of things, there are certain people, which we can't relate to, certain Yehudei Skula, who for them, the inappropriate things that Chazal and the Torah were trying to separate from us from, they couldn't relate to it. It was something which didn't affect them. So in terms of Yaakov, so whether you're saying that it's his relative, whether you say that it was that she was young, whether it was just that there was no affection involved, whatever it is, it's because it's Yaakov Avinu. On the level of Yaakov Avinu, there was absolutely nothing going on here. It was, as that Rashi implies, of some sort of spiritual connection between them. So yes, is it possible that he shouldn't have done that in that context? Maybe Rav Acha also, meaning his Talmidim questioned them also, and maybe there should have been a concern for the V'yis and the Kiyim of making sure that people shouldn't be talking and learning to act inappropriately. But on their level, it was nothing that they that should be questioned. And I think that's the approach that which really guides most of Sefer Bereishis, is in terms of understanding the characters. The Torah gives it to us in our context, in terms of we have to try and relate on our level and learn from them. And you know, we can say a word here and an explanation here, and that's what we're supposed to be doing. But at the same time, I think also the Torah is challenging us to make sure not to, you can't denigrate them. You can't bring them down to your level. It's our job to try and raise ourselves up as much as possible. Will we reach the level of the Avos? Halavai, probably not. But we try. We try to be the best that we can. But part of the challenge, I think, in the Torah, putting in such events, is to understand and be able to appreciate and be able to raise ourselves above what we might think at first glance, and to show them, no, these are the Avos HaKadoshim. These are people, again, if you go back to what we began with, when you see that newspaper article, and somebody, again, that you know, you can't imagine, you know, whoever this person is a serial killer. How could a person be a serial killer? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. So it must be that there's more to it. It must be that you have to delve deeper into it. And it's the same thing, I think, that the Torah challenges us by putting in these things. The Torah could have skipped this. What's the big deal? Doesn't tell us every event, does every conversation that Yaakov had with the Rome, tells us one thing. But I think part of what the Torah does in a lot of these events with the Avos is challenges us to learn from their lessons, but also not to bring them down, to be able to relate to them as our Avos, as our spiritual patriarchs who inspire us and give us a model for which we can rise up to. In terms of halacha lemaisa, not taking anything out of our words, it needs to be discussed in the posting, but in terms of the general model, in terms of giving appropriate credit to Yaakov Avinu, I think at least we try to provide a framework. Thank you.